All right. Well, I am here with former Governor Christine Todd Whitman. It certainly is a pleasure to meet you here today.
No, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You certainly have had quite a career, and I didn't realize that your whole family was in politics.
To one degree or another, everybody was. We were brought up that way because my parents were very involved. My grandparents were involved, so it goes back a ways.
Did you ever have any desire to do anything different?
No, I always wanted to be in public policy. I never knew I'd run for public office. That was never sort of, it wasn't a lifelong goal. But since I was brought up as, I was the youngest of four, youngest by 8 years. So by the time my parents got around to me, they had given up and I got to go to all the things with them that they were doing. So I was in and around government and politics. They were never in elective office. They were just very supportive and from a partisan political point of view. But it meant that I saw a lot of what was going on, and the topic of the dining room conversation was always about what was happening in the locally, in the state, in the nation, in the world. And so I grew up being fascinated by that. So I always wanted to stay involved in policy.
That's interesting. When you were in college or when you were in school, did you ever run for political office?
Oh, I was, you know, president of the Republican Club and that kind of thing. And I organized current event clubs and things like that wherever I was. But It wasn't a burning desire to be in public office.
Then what made you go that direction?
Well, when after my husband and I got married, we moved to England for 2.5 years. And when I came back and our daughter was born, I got on the County College Board of Trustees and got to meet people. And by then I was thinking, you know, public office would be kind of fun. And at the local level, we call them freeholders or county commissioners everywhere else. That's an executive job. And I was asked if I would consider running for that, and I did. And then Then the governor asked me to join his cabinet as president of the Board of Public Utilities, which I took on, and you know, one thing led to another. I just decided that I really, after serving in an appointed position, that I actually really enjoyed the elective more, because you have a better relationship with your constituents. It's a more direct one. And then I ran for the U.S. Senate and was barely beaten in a contest where I was expected to be blown away. And after that, it just... Then I was able to run for governor.
And you won.
Yeah, I won.
And you won.
Yeah.
That was unusual. Don't you think that, do you think politics have changed from the time when you were running and everything? It just seems like it is so nasty anymore.
Well, it was pretty nasty then. Those who ran the campaign against me, actually, Paul Begala and James Carville. And I saw Paul Begala afterwards, and he said, you know, I don't know how you won, because we wanted, the ads we ran, we wanted people not just to vote against you, we wanted them to actively dislike you. And they were pretty rough ads. If anyone just knew me from those ads, they would have thought that I drove drunk every night, hanging out the window with my Uzi shooting up watermelons, because that's what the ads were like. And it was very good for the farmers, because they sold a lot of watermelons, I guess, to shoot the ads. But it was... You know, it's been nasty all the way along, but not as bad. It's not been as partisan in the policy-making part of it as it is today. Campaigns were always rough. Campaigns have been tough and rough, and, you know, it's a competitive process. But once you're in office, the difference is people are supposed to be statespeople then and solve problems, and that's not happening the way we need to have it happen.
You know, one of the things that, of course, you were the head of the EPA for President Bush, and you had kind of, what shall we say, your policy was not quite in line with where they were going with this. What do you think about today, though? Do you think that we should relax some of the policy? I mean, we have the coal mines being shut down. We have the oceans being taken over by the government. They want to take it over for the zoning and everything. What do you think should be the role of the EPA when it comes to the where our economy is now?
Well, EPA's role is to protect public health and the health of the environment, and they need to do that. I mean, people forget that back in 1970 when Richard Nixon established the Environmental Protection Agency, it was because rivers were spontaneously combusting. We were turning our land into a garbage heap, and people were dying every summer because of bad air quality. So to walk away from that would be very dangerous, because we can get right back there very fast. However, we go through periods, and we're one of these periods now, where you have a lot of overreach, I think, and you need to strike a balance. Now, part of the problem is, and part of it is administration policy, but the other part of the problem is people forget that when the Environmental Protection Agency was established, Congress was very prescriptive in the way it wrote the enabling legislation, and they didn't give it much leeway on things like clean air. They said you have to discuss these things in a certain time period. You don't have any flexibility. You can, in some instances, consider cost-benefit analysis, but you absolutely can't in others. And that was all directed by Congress. So part of the EPA and what they're doing is responding to lawsuits. Most of it is driven by lawsuits because they get taken to court for not having done enough. And they generally lose. But there is certainly a desire on this administration to go as far as you can. And you have to strike a balance. You have to understand this is not a zero-sum game. It's not either a clean and green environment or a healthy, thriving economy. You can and must have both things. And it's finding that middle ground that allows you to be protective, appropriately protective, of the environment and human health and still allow for sustainable economic growth.
Do you think we have the possibility of getting that, though?
Unfortunately not, because all you hear from the two sides are one extreme or the other. It's either we got to do everything and the environment is the only thing that matters, to the others who say, no, business is the only thing that matters. It's a little bit like, for instance, the fracking debate. Fracking is a technology that's been used for a long time. Mm-hmm. And in underground injection of water with chemicals is something that's been done safely in many, many parts of the country. But it's not appropriate everywhere. If you're starting to do it, in my belief, in an area where you could jeopardize the water supply to literally tens of thousands of people, that's probably not the place to do it. Look elsewhere first, because the cost that you'd have to pay for putting in a whole new water system to supply these people far outweighs the benefit that you get from the oil extraction from that particular place. But on the other hand, we are very good in this country of finding something wrong with everything and saying no to everything, and we've got to get over that. We've got to understand that we need affordable, reliable, clean energy, which means we're going to have a variety of things. We just need to make sure that we make it as clean and as safe as possible. Coal will always be part of our energy. So will oil and gas.
Keep closing it down.
No, it'll always be part. It's 48% of our overall energy mix. There is no substitute for that. It's just like nuclear is 20% of our energy, but 70% of our clean energy. We need to keep nuclear going, and South Carolina is doing a wonderful job at that, as is Georgia. And they will be very happy when they've finished with those projects because of the benefits that they bring. But we're going to have an all-of-the-above strategy.
Absolutely. Now, you were considered in the media. They said that you could be in the cabinet of either Barack Obama or John McCain.
No.
Could you be in Barack Obama's cabinet?
Well, Republicans have done those kinds of things. They get excoriated for doing it. But, if a president-elect asks you to serve at the national level, and if it is an important position, and if you agree with them, if you agree with the goals and what they're trying to accomplish, you're serving your country. You're not serving that party.
Mm-hmm.
You're serving your country. And that's what we've got to understand. We in the past have had people of the other party. Dwight Eisenhower had a Secretary of the Treasury. It wasn't Dwight Eisenhower. John Kennedy had a Secretary of the Treasury who was a Republican, Douglas Dillon. We've had this before, and people need to understand that while it may not be the most comfortable thing for them, it's about serving your country.
Absolutely.
Before your party.
Yeah, absolutely. How effective do you think the Tea Party is today?
Well, the Tea Party has certainly changed a lot of the discussion. It started out, to my mind, actually, interestingly enough, reacting to the same set of problems that the 99%ers, the Wall Street people, are reacting to, which is a frustration with the amount of spending that goes on in Congress, with the deficit that we have in this country, and with the lack of progress in problem solving. They just come at it two entirely different ways. One thinks
exactly.
Government has all the answers, and the other thinks government shouldn't be anywhere at all. The problem I have with many of the Tea Party members who went to Congress is they all signed the No New Taxpayers Pledge, which means that they gave up a tool when we had that budget discussion where they could have closed some loopholes that everyone agreed needed to be closed, but those would have resulted in some people paying more, and that pledge wouldn't allow them to do it. We'd given away a negotiating tool. Speaker Boehner didn't have the same kind of ability to negotiate get us further down the road to a balanced budget, which is what everybody wants. So they signed a short-term pledge that made everybody feel good, and they lost, I think, in the long term. We all lost a bit in the long term.
Absolutely. Do you think there will be a budget before the election?
Well, they're starting to try to, people are trying to crank up and say, yes, they're trying to look for the hopeful signs that there may be a budget, but I'm not terribly sanguine that there will be. The partisanship is so deep. I mean, every policy issue now is looked at through the political prism. It's not how do we solve this problem, it's how do I get another vote in caucus, how do I get another percentage on my reelect, and all of these issues are ones that, taken in sound bites, which is how we do policy these days, can be used to beat up the other side, and that temptation is so great that I don't know that they'll recognize that the long term they're hurting themselves in their reelect because people are suffering. And not having a budget is exacerbating those problems. I don't know that they'll recognize that in time.
Absolutely. Now, why is it so important? Why is it so important that women become involved in politics?
Because today's issues are so complex and so large that there's no one group that has all the answers. And we need people with different life experiences, with different ways of problem solving, with different ways of looking at issues, to be able to come up with a kind of policy decisions that'll stand the test of time. And that means we need more women and we need more minorities. I mean, we do prioritize differently. We do address issues differently. We do have different life experiences, and we need to be there at the decision-making table.
Absolutely. So South Carolina, lowest numbers of women in politics.
Yes, but one of only six female governors in the country today, so
yes.
You can be proud of that, and
Absolutely.
Several other very strong women. And that's why the Institute is so important for the Southeastern women in politics. It's really important to give women the kind of networking opportunity and exposure to politics and political office and the kinds of offices that are available that will encourage them to get involved, because they really need to. It's more than just, it's not an ego thing. Usually women who come to political office do so because they want to solve a problem. Many don't see the ability to solve a problem today because so many of our levels of government are virtually dysfunctional. But it's not going to change unless the people who care and want to see that change get involved.
Absolutely. And just one last question. Do you believe Governor Romney can win?
I think it's going to be a very difficult election for him. He's got a lot of things he's going to have thought through thoroughly this time, answers, to have quick answers as to where he's changed his position on things. I am involved with something called Americans Elect. AmericansElect.org is the website, and that is it's open to anyone who is a registered voter. They can all become delegates. We have over 400,000 delegates, and they will be in June choosing a bipartisan ticket that will be on the ballot in every state in the nation this fall as a third choice for people.
All right. Thank you so much. And I just want to say, it's your party, right? I love that.
I'm not so sure anymore.
It's my party. I thought that was great when you did that. It's my party. It was good. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.